Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, the Congressional Budget Office released a tough assessment of the House Republicans' health care plan. Up to 24 million fewer Americans with coverage over the next decade. The White House disputes the figures from the nonpartisan scorekeeper. The administration says the picture is incomplete. This hour on Point, the Republican health care plan and its consequences. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is this an improvement? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at the administration's failure to produce evidence yesterday supporting President Trump's wiretapping accusations against President Trump and the implications of that. But first, the Congressional Budget Office speaks on Republican health care plans. Here was the president himself yesterday afternoon. He gathered his cabinet at the White House for the first time, thanked House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell while touting what he described the benefits of a proposal to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act.
The House plan will expand choice, lower costs, and ensure health care access for all. We're negotiating with everybody. It's a big, fat, beautiful negotiation. And hopefully we'll come up with something that's going to be really terrific.
We'll look at that. Expand choice, lower cost, and ensure health care for all. The numbers themselves disputed. Secretary of Health and Human Services Tom Price said the Congressional Budget Office only looked at part of the plan, not the entire plan. He said, don't get the whole picture here.
We disagree strenuously with the report that was put out. We believe that our plan will cover more individuals at a lower cost and give them the choices that they want for the coverage that they want for themselves and for their family, not that the government forces them to buy.
Democrats ready to take the CBO numbers and run with them. New York Democrat Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer urged the GOP to pull its health care proposal.
Trump care means higher costs for less coverage. The CBO report should be a knockout blow for Republicans in Congress. They should heed this warning and turn back from their plan that would be a disaster for the country.
All right, let's look. Joining us from Rockville, Maryland is Julie Robner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks.
And to look at where all this goes in Congress, Rachel Bade is with us. She covers Congress and the House leadership for Politico. Rachel Bade in Washington, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much.
All right. Julie, to the president's assertions yesterday with his cabinet that this will expand choice, lower cost, and ensure health care access for all. Do the CBO numbers speak to those assertions?
Not really. Generally, the Republicans have done basically what the Democrats did in 2009, which is make promises that they can't keep. What the CBO says is that, yes, for some people, mostly younger, healthier people, costs will go down, but for other people, older, sicker people, costs will go up, and costs will go up dramatically. And as you pointed out, when this all shakes out, it would result in 24 million fewer people having coverage after 10 years than would have it if the ACA were just to continue as is.
Well, this is a long way 10 years out from where I think people imagined we might end up when the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare was first getting off the ground. We're talking about 10 years out, 52 millions without health insurance. That seems like a gigantic number. I mean, we're a big country, but that's a big number, Julie.
That's a very big number. Actually, it's slightly larger than the number before the Affordable Care Act. Mainly what this comes from is buried in this law is a huge sort of systemic change to the Medicaid program for the poor, which now serves more than 70 million people. People have no idea just how big Medicaid is, and that's not just this transition population, the people who are added because of the Affordable Care Act. This is partly because Medicaid also serves low-income elderly people who often need long-term care, and they were middle class, but they've now spent down and are poor. There are disabled people, and there are pregnant women and children. And this would basically, for the first time, cap the amount that the federal government would spend for Medicaid. It's always been an open-ended program. The federal government matches whatever states spend. That would no longer be the case, and that's where a big chunk of this reduction in insured people comes from, according to the CBO.
Paul Ryan, for a long time, wanting to maybe cap entitlements, and there might be an example right there. Rachel Bate at Politico, you and your colleagues are writing that this put Republican leadership into damage control. You describe it as a brutal budgetary assessment of their replacement plan for Obamacare, and say that it threatened to upend Senate GOP support. Can the Republicans rally around this, Rachel?
Yeah, so this is a very, this totally changes the dynamic, I think, on Capitol Hill here in Washington. We've sort of heard most of the squawking coming from the far right conservatives saying this is, quote, Obamacare light, you know, threatening to vote against the bill because they don't think it repeals enough. And they don't like the changes that Speaker Paul Ryan is shepherding, this idea of doing tax credits instead of subsidies. They say it's a new entitlement. We've been hearing a lot from the far right. This is going to bring the moderates and the centrists out of the woodwork. We're already seeing moderates come out and say, listen, I can't vote for this bill. We saw one Republican from Virginia specifically just hours after the report say, I can't vote for this. This is not right for my constituents. We're also seeing Senate Republicans who tend to be more pragmatic in their thinking, I guess you would say, given that they're elected every 6 years mm-hmm. instead of every two. And they're trying to distance themselves from this. John Cornyn was saying, this is the House plan. You know, we'll work on it here in the Senate. Rob Portman, solid Republican ally for GOP leadership traditionally, said he's worried about the Medicaid changes and what it's going to do to his constituents in Ohio. And so the bottom line is that Ryan, the House GOP leaders, they want to sort of point to these rosier elements of the CBO report, like the 10% decrease in premiums over 10 years and the fact that it will cut the deficit by $330 billion over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people are focused on this 24 million number, this number of the people who will lose insurance, either from Medicaid or just stop buying it. And that's going to be a really tough sell for moderates who are skittish about, you know, what's going to happen to them back home and to their constituents and on the ballot in 2018.
I want to ask you about that. I mean, Paul Ryan on the Sunday shows, he was philosophical about this. Here he was on Face the Nation on CBS and saying, well, you know, some people would lose coverage. He was asked about that by John Dickerson there, but he really went to a more philosophical view on Sunday of what's going on.
I can't answer that question. It's up to people. Here's the premise of your question. Are you going to stop mandating people buy health insurance? People are going to do what they want to do with their lives because we believe in individual freedom in this country. So the question is, are we providing a system where people have access to health insurance if they choose to do so? And the answer is yes.
Access. Access is a big word there. I want to bring that to you, Julie. But Rachel, first on this philosophical issue, Paul Ryan sounds as though he's saying, well, sure, people may lose health insurance, but, you know, you'll have more freedom. What did Janis Joplin say? It's just another word for nothing left to lose. But is that a compelling argument among a majority, a sufficient number of Republicans in Congress these days, Rachel?
You know, that's going to be the ultimate test right there. It's a totally different tack than President Trump has been saying. You know, we've heard him say, insurance for all. People will not lose coverage. I think as recently as Sunday, Tom Price said that he didn't think people would be hurt financially from this and that he thought people could continue on their insurance. But Ryan has been coaching this, like, very delicately for the past few months because he knew that we were going to see numbers, maybe not this high, 24 million, but he did know that under this plan, more people would not be uninsured in the future. And so it's going to come down to, you know, Republicans philosophically saying this is not the government's job to tell you, you have to get health care. They have a right. Should they not get health care? If they don't want it, they don't have to get it. But, you know, people are still going to be seizing other Republicans, centrists and moderates are still going to be very worried about this. Because what about people who want it and don't have access to it?
Let's go right to our callers, and then I'll bring it to you, Julie. Nancy in Buffalo, New York. Nancy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, yes, this is what I'm wondering about. The Trump party keeps talking about everyone will have access to health care, and they keep using the word access.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, this is meaningless because I would love to buy myself a Rolls Royce, but I can't afford it, so I can't get one.
Even though it's at the dealership, you could hypothetically go in and buy it, but you don't have the cash, the bank.
Right, and I'm also concerned about the elderly who require nursing home care and home health care. How will the states be able to bear the burden of that cost if the federal government limits their contribution?
Nancy, we'll look at that as well before we finish here. But let me take first, and appreciate your call from Buffalo. Julie Robner, this issue of access. Paul Ryan uses this word all the time now when he talks about health care. President Trump, as Rachel points out, said, hey, we're going to have this for everyone. But Paul Ryan uses the word access. And what does he mean by that, Julie?
Well, this was actually the crux of the healthcare argument back in the very early 1990s, actually before Bill Clinton. That's how long I've been doing this. The fight was universal coverage versus universal access. The Democrats wanted universal coverage. The Republicans wanted universal access. And it meant something at that point, because basically if you bought your own insurance, if you were in the individual market and you had a pre-existing condition, you frequently didn't have access. No matter how much money you had, insurers would not sell to you. So that was one of the things that was taken care of in the Affordable Care Act, and that is something that the Republicans say that they do not want to repeal because it is very popular. So I think that's what they're talking about when they say people will continue to have access. What they don't then go on to say is that, yes, you can buy insurance, but it might be prohibitively expensive. But originally when they were talking about access, they were mostly talking about getting rid of the pre-existing condition provisions that allowed insurers to decline to cover people altogether.
But access, I mean, I'm reading one analysis here that talks about a person who would be, let's say, 64 years old with a low income, $26,500, and that their premium, their annual premium under this Trump care, whatever you want to call it, they make $26,500, their premium would be $14,600.
That's right. And I mean, compared to $1,700 under the Affordable Care Act.
I mean, Rachel, that's pretty explosive politically. Who makes $26,000 a year can afford to spend $14,000 on health insurance?
No one. I can't think of a person. And I think that example that was specifically put in the CBO score, that registered with a lot of people here on the Hill and worried a lot of Democrats and a lot of centrist Republicans, moderate Republicans.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the pretty brutal Congressional Budget Office assessment of the likely impact of the Republican replacement for the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Later in this hour, we'll look at the Trump administration yesterday failing to meet a House Intelligence Committee deadline for evidence to back up the president's unsubstantiated claim that he was wiretapped by past President Barack Obama, then sitting president. You can join us. We're looking at this health care plan. What do you think of it? What do you think of what you're hearing? What will happen when millions lose coverage, when older Americans see higher premiums? And what's the real battle here? What's playing out? Is it worth it to you for those savings on the deficit? 10 years out, 24 million more people would be without insurance, is the CBO bottom line. On the other hand, they say that, yeah, there'd be a $337 billion reduction in the deficit. And over time, not right away, premiums would go up, but over time they go down a little bit, maybe 10%. Rachel Bate is with us from Politico, Julie Robner from Kaiser Healthcare News. Rachel, you were in the middle of looking at that hit that some would take with their higher premiums and how that's likely to play out politically as lawmakers contemplate that.
Yeah, you specifically noted that, you know, an elderly person, 64 years old, earning $26,000 a year, their premiums would go from about $1,700 under the current system to about $14,000 under this new bill. The interesting thing about this example that a lot of people on the Hill are talking about is that we're talking about Trump's core base here, people who are a little older, not too wealthy, you know, middle income, potentially even lower income. These are the folks who the CBO said are going to be hit the most. And that's interesting to me from a political standpoint because, you know, these are the folks who really rallied behind Trump. And it'll be interesting to see if Trump looks at that and decides, okay, we got to make some changes for these folks. Because right now we're hearing out of the White House that over the weekend they were actually talking to conservatives to make the bill even more conservative because they felt they needed the votes in the House. And then the only way they could get it to pass and to get these conservatives on board, these conservatives who call this, quote, Obamacare light, is to take it further to the right. And so I'm curious to see if Trump decides, after saying this, that this is his base and he needs to make some changes to this bill to sort of protect those people who voted for him. The other thing I wanted to mention was we hear, and you played a little bit of this at the beginning of the show, mm-hmm. We hear the White House saying the CBO score is wrong.
All over the place today. Yeah.
All over the place, yes. And it's interesting because one of my colleagues last night intercepted the White House's own score on this, and it's actually worse than the CBO score. So even while they're discrediting,
what do you mean intercepted? Are you tapping Trump Tower now too?
Well, let's just say we have some good reporters
okay.
here at Politico, and he covers healthcare, and he got a copy of this score coming out of the White House, and this score says that 26 million people would lose their coverage over a decade. That's 2 million more than the 24 million the CBO predicted. We're talking 17 million off of Medicaid, 6 million from the individual market, and 3 million from employer-based plans, basically employers deciding they're not going to, you know, offer insurance anymore
yep.
because the employer mandate is gone. And that is particularly interesting to me given what they're saying publicly about how this CBO score is wrong. And internally, theirs is worse.
A couple of questions here, Julie, for you. First, I mean, the flip side of what older Americans would look at, there would be a little savings for younger Americans. That same analysis says 21-year-old, same income, 26.5. Their premium would drop from $1,700 to $1,450, so $250 there. What about for younger Americans? What's the impact? What would the impact be of this Republican plan, Julie?
Younger Americans would clearly do better, and that's one of the things that the CBO says. That's the main reason they see a decrease, like that 10% decrease in premiums over 10 years, is that it would be much cheaper for younger people. More younger people would get in. That would balance the risk pool. That's the good news. But as you and Rachel have pointed out, the bad news is that it would dramatically increase the cost for those older Americans. Now, we're not talking about people on Medicare. We're talking about people mainly between 55 and 64, or to some extent between 50 and 64, and somebody tweeted last night that on Capitol Hill those are known as quote people who vote.
Yeah, I mean, also I'm thinking about that young person who saves $250, but their grandmother's premium goes up of $12,000 to $14,500 or $14,600. I mean, they might feel a little guilty. I mean, they're saving some money, but it goes up so high at the other end. Lucy in Tallinn, Connecticut. Lucy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
I just think the Republicans should start doing their job. They've been through this with the Democrats when they created the Affordable Care Act. They repealed it 52 times. They should now know what they want. They haven't changed. They should know what they want to put in the new act and stop just going along with anything Donald Trump says.
Well, I mean, it seems to me, let us pick it up. Rachel, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that it is the House Republicans driving this, not Donald Trump at this point, even though he was talking yesterday about a big, beautiful, fat negotiation, whatever that means. Who's driving the architecture here, Rachel?
Oh, absolutely. This is Speaker Ryan, 100%. In fact, you know, we're seeing a little tug of war playing out here on the Hill, where you have Speaker Ryan, who's put forward this plan, conservatives who want to make it more conservative and just repeal it first and then go back and do a replacement later, don't offer tax credits to people to, you know, purchase insurance, which they call a, quote, entitlement. They have been trying to tell leadership to change the bill. Leadership says no. We're not going to do this. And so they're going around leadership to Trump, and everybody's trying to appeal to Trump right now. You have the conservatives going to him and saying, we're not going to vote for this because it's not conservative enough. You have Ryan, who talks to him every single day, multiple times a day on the phone to try to, you know, explain the policy ins and outs of this. Obviously, Speaker Ryan is known to be a policy wonk in and out. And so he's having to explain to Trump why he decided to craft the bill this way. And now we're going to see, as we're seeing for the past, 12 hours, moderates and centrists freak out and say, we can't do it this way. We have to change this. And so they're going to be going to the White House and saying, we can't vote for this. It's just this big tug of war. Everyone's trying to get Trump on their side. But really, this bill that we're seeing today, the score that the CBO score on this bill, this is 100% a House Republican plan driven by Paul Ryan.
Stephen in Savannah, Georgia. Stephen, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I do not know what to believe. Yeah. We were told one thing with the Affordable Health Care Act. I kept my private policies on my wife and my kids.
Okay.
Our premiums went up. We went from $563 to almost $1,000.
A month.
51 years old, two kids. Prior, we heard Pelosi say, well, we got to read it, pass it to see what's in it. And then everything turned out not to be true. Now we hear, oh, we got to read it all. But from where I'm sitting as a working class American male trying to provide for his family.
Yes, sir.
And afford insurance without a ridiculously high deductible, I just do not know what to believe. And where does the average American, as myself and my wife, trying to do right by our kids and our family, where do we fall in all of this argument and discussion?
I mean, it's such a broad question, but it is the question. Stephen, let us pick it up, and I'm really glad you put it just that way. Julie, you know, after all these years, you think about somebody in Stephen's situation, and there are millions and millions and millions just like that. Who's looking out for people? How are people supposed to decide where to throw their shoulder here? Nobody in Washington will even agree on the numbers.
Well, I will say that there are some millions of people who are in exactly that situation. It's not millions and millions. The vast majority of people still get their insurance on the job or from the government through Medicare, Medicaid, or the VA. But there have always been a number of people who are usually self-employed or work for a business that doesn't offer insurance who buy their own coverage. As I mentioned earlier, previously it was only available to healthy people, so their premiums were relatively low. The Affordable Care Act changed that, and it said that, okay, sick people get to buy insurance too. That runs up prices, but we're going to give tax credits to a lot of people. The people who got hurt were the people who make over 400% of poverty. They are paying the entire increased premiums, and they are not getting help. Now, under the Republican plan, they would get help, at least up to $75,000 for an individual, up to $150,000 for a family, so a little bit higher than the help goes in the Affordable Care Act. They would get some relief, but that it's not. It's a group that genuinely got hurt. It's just not a very big group. It's probably 6 or 7 million people. But I'm not doubting that they are definitely hurting. They have borne the brunt of the increases. It's not clear how much the Republican plan would help them, though, because it's not at all clear that it would bring down premiums very much.
When we talk then about 10 years out there being 52 million people, Americans, without health insurance in this country, who are they? What's the profile?
Well, they are a combination of people, of the 28 million who don't have it now, some of whom are paying the penalty instead of buying insurance, some of whom are ineligible in the states that didn't expand Medicaid. They earn they're not eligible for Medicaid at all, and they don't earn enough. You actually have to earn 100% of poverty to get help on the exchanges.
Right.
They are people according to the CBO, it's about half people from who will be dropped off of Medicaid for one reason or another, and about half people who will no longer be buying in the individual insurance market. Presumably, those 64-year-olds who make $26,000 a year and can't afford to spend half of that on health insurance premiums.
And you mentioned the employer mandate going away under the Republican plan. Explain what you're describing there.
Well, there's a requirement in the law that large employers have to either provide health insurance, or if one of their employees went to the exchange and got a premium subsidy, that they would pay a fine. And that will go away. Interestingly, there's been a lot of research on this. It turns out that hasn't had much impact on employers offering coverage. There's an upswing in the economy. People value this as a good benefit. Employers get a big tax deduction for offering it. So, in fact, most employers have continued to offer coverage, and that, in fact, is the reason why the CBO original estimate was so wrong about how many people would be in the exchanges. The CBO originally assumed that more employers would drop coverage and let their employees go to the exchanges. That hasn't happened. Interestingly, it may have contributed to some of the instability in the exchanges, because people who have jobs are generally healthier, so they haven't come into that risk pool and made it healthier. But the general consensus is that taking away the employer mandate probably wouldn't have much of an impact one way or the other on how many employers offer coverage.
We're looking at the new CBO, Congressional Budget Office, assessment of the House Republican health care plan. Rachel Bade with Politico. There is a tax cut in here, a substantial one, and it would go mainly to upper-income Americans. Here's a little sound of Nancy Pelosi going straight at that yesterday.
$600 billion going from working families to the richest people and corporations in our country. So in terms of insurance coverage, it's immoral. In terms of giving money to the rich at the expense of working families, it is indecent and wrong.
Rachel Bade, I guess that's primarily unwinding the taxes that were implemented to help pay for the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. What about that? Is that a big incentive for a bunch of Republicans to vote for this because there's a tax cut, even if it's for the rich? Or especially because, I don't know.
It's certainly some red meat they're throwing to the right there. $883 billion, that's how much we're going to see in terms of tax cuts over the next decade. And you're right, this is basically unwinding all the taxes that were imposed to pay in part for Obamacare, half decade or so ago. We Republicans have been complaining about these taxes for years, so naturally they're replacement is going to scale these back. Now, you have an optics problem where since the increases were put mostly on wealthier individuals when Obamacare was enacted, scaling them back means a tax cut for wealthier individuals. And you're at the same time, you're putting that against, a piece of information from the CBO score saying that, grandma who makes $26,000 is going to have to pay $14,000 for a premium. I mean, so this is going to create an optics issue for Republicans, no doubt about that. I will say that we've heard a lot of Republicans complaining that they don't repeal the taxes soon enough in this this specific proposal. Some of these taxes won't be phased out for a little bit, and they want them phased out now. So if anything, we're hearing from Republicans that they need to do it sooner, which will cost more money. And again, create that optics issue that we're just speaking of.
Yeah, Julie, let me ask you about the president's depiction at this cabinet meeting, first cabinet meeting yesterday. He said, we have no choice. Obamacare is imploding. Here he was.
Obamacare, all of a sudden, the last couple of weeks, is getting a false rep that maybe it's okay. It's not okay. It's a disaster. And people understand that. It's failed. And it's imploding. And if we let it go for another year, it'll totally implode. In fact, I've told the Republicans, why don't you just let it go for another year? That way everybody will really understand how bad it is. But it would be the wrong thing for us to do and for the American people.
I don't know what to believe when the president makes a statement like that these days, Julie. Is Obamacare imploding?
Not really. There are definitely problems in the market. If Hillary Clinton had been elected, that we would be having not exactly the same debate, but we would be having a similar debate. Companies are, right now, it's just the uncertainty that's leaving insurance companies not sure. Remember, they don't have to offer coverage in the individual market. A lot of them came in sort of tentatively and started to, who hadn't offered individual coverage before, to see if, they could make this work. Some of them have made it work. Some of them, rather famously, have not. Humana has already announced that it will not be offering coverage next year. In 2018, they were the only insurer in a number of places, including a number of counties in Tennessee. So, I mean, there is a question about what will happen next year if nothing happens. But was it actually imploding and collapsing? No.
Rachel, what's going to happen here? How do the Republicans wrestle this thing to the ground? Well, I mean, I know you don't know the outcome, but what's the procedure now?
It's kind of a debate going on in the press galleries among lawmakers, Democrats, Republicans alike. Where does this end up? And it's going to be interesting to watch because leadership in Trump, they're really being torn in two different directions. You have conservatives who want to go for the right, centrist and moderate Republicans who are looking at this CBO score and just petrified, scared for their political lives and for their constituents and who don't want to vote for this. So I do think that Republicans will at some point pass something. I don't know if it'll look like this. I don't know if it comes to the floor and it fails a couple of times before they actually get this through. But they're basically, they have this balancing act. They're trying to get to 216 votes in the House, and that is requiring some serious backward bending. I think that what we're going to see is President Trump, who is adamant about getting, this checked off his list, the campaign promise he said he would make, I think we're going to see him start to be more aggressive against people who are threatening to vote against this. We already sort of started to see that when he sent Mike Pence to Kentucky to sort of troll Rand Paul. Well, we're probably going to see Trump himself go out to these members' districts and say, listen, I'm trying to repeal Obamacare. Your member is standing in the way. You need to call them and try to shame them into voting for it.
Rachel Bade at Politico, covering all of this on Capitol Hill. Thank you so much for being with us today, Rachel.
Happy to be here.
And Julie Rovner, the always great Julie Rovner at Kaiser Health News. Thank you for joining us, Julie.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Little break here. We'll come back and look at the president's claim that Barack Obama wiretapped him in Trump Tower. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, it's Tom. I'm glad you're listening to this On Point podcast. Really happy to have you here. You know, a lot of people barely know podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. Here at On Point, we want to change that. All this month, we're inviting our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. Do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod. And thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The House Intelligence Committee deadline for the Justice Department to produce evidence backing up President Trump's allegation that President Obama wiretapped Trump Tower came and went yesterday, that deadline. No evidence. The Justice Department asked for more time. There is no precedent for the sitting president's accusation that his predecessor, Barack Obama, tapped him during the campaign. We're going to look at this. You can join us. What does it mean when a sitting president doesn't back up this very hot claim? On Sunday, Arizona Republican Senator John McCain was on CNN's State of the Union, said President Trump needs to provide proof that President Obama wiretapped him or say he's retracting the charge.
The president has one of two choices, either retract or to provide the information that the American people deserve, because if his predecessor violated the law, President Obama violated the law, we've got a serious issue here, to say the least.
Yesterday, there was no retraction, and there was also no evidence. Instead, at a press conference at the White House, Press Secretary Sean Spicer was dancing. Here he was.
He doesn't really think that President Obama went up and tapped his phone personally. I think, but I think there's no question that the Obama administration, that there were actions about surveillance and other activities that occurred in the 2016 election. That is a widely reported activity that occurred back then. The president used the word wiretap in quotes to mean broadly surveillance and other activities during that.
Well, we'll look at what the president tweeted and more with us to help us do that. Peter Nicholas, White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Peter Nicholas, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
With us from Washington there. And from Berkeley, California, Thomas Mann joins us, senior fellow governance studies at the Brookings Institution, co-author with Norm Ornstein of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Thomas Mann, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
Let's just review for a second, Peter Nicholas, what the president tweeted a week ago now. There's several tweets. One, I bet this is 6:52 in the morning. The president tweeting, I'd bet a good lawyer could make a great case out of the fact that President Obama was tapping my phones in October just prior to the election. There's the first one. Second, how low has President Obama gone to tap my phones during the very sacred election process? This is Nixon, Watergate, bad or sick guy. And finally, here we go. Terrible. Just found out Obama had my wires tapped in Trump Tower just before the victory. Nothing found. This is McCarthyism. Peter Nicholas, here we are a week later. Those are big charges. Yesterday, zero evidence, as far as I know, from the Justice Department. Where do things stand?
Well, we really haven't advanced much beyond those initial claims, which have never been substantiated. And you're correct. The President Trump could not have been more clear. He said Obama did this personally. He was very clear that there was wiretapping going on. That was a week and a half ago. The White House has yet to produce any evidence. House Intelligence Committees have demanded it. But I think what happened yesterday at the White House press briefing room, Tom, is significant. I think we saw for the very first time a walk back from Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, saying that what Trump meant here was not that Obama personally tapped the phones. He's trying to broaden, offer a broader definition of wiretapping, which is the word Trump used, to say broader surveillance, and made it much more vague than Trump actually specified. So I think we have to interpret that as something of a climb down from where we were when Trump first tweeted this. It's somewhat significant because the White House has not yet up to this point, the White House has really not backed off the claim. They've not substantiated it either. But I think in terms of interpreting the Kremlinology, so to speak, at work here, we have to conclude that this was a something of a walk back from Sean Spicer.
Thomas Mann, does that make everything okay if there's a little climb down or you fuzz it up a little bit, despite the fair clarity of what the president wrote, tweeted, put out to the whole world? Does it just kind of evaporate and that's okay, no problem, no harm, no foul?
That's called defining deviancy down. What's really terrifying about this episode is that it's the new normal in the White House. The series of tweets from the president about his predecessor on this matter were stunning in one sense because of the unprecedented and outrageous nature of the charge without evidence at all. But in another sense, it wasn't surprising. Donald Trump saw a story, on social media, probably Breitbart's story, and tweeted in response to it. He has news sources he trusts, and when he sees something that catches his attention, there's no thought process in between. His fingers go to his smartphone, and the tweets are out there in the world. It's very, very disturbing. I mean, we have a larger problem with the absence of truth in this administration and more broadly in this government, including the Republican majority in the Congress, and this is just another illustration of it. It's eerie.
Tom Mann, I want to be careful here. We don't want to normalize this. I mean, you talk about how well this is just we're getting used to this, but is there any precedent for a sitting president to make a charge like this against a predecessor? And just remind us of the weight of this charge.
Listen, I'm not trying to normalize it. I'm trying to reinforce people about the broader outrageousness of the way in which this president communicates, lacking evidence, lacking truth. And now, you're right, it's important to underscore this particular incident. I mean, it's so absolutely outrageous, and Peter is right, they're trying to walk it back, but listen, the way to walk it back is to say, one, I withdraw the charge and I apologize. I mean, that would be the way to do it if they were serious about it. But Donald Trump's operating principles don't let him ever apologize for anything. The strategy is just keep the pressure up, and the bigger the lie, the more likely it is that the base will accept it.
I mean, there is a problem here because this is the president of the United States. When that person speaks or writes, you want it to be with a certain authority, and that came up in the press conference yesterday with Sean Spicer. First Spicer saying, well, fuzzing it up, as you say, but then NBC's Peter Alexander asked Spicer when Americans can trust the president.
Can you say affirmatively that whenever the president says something, we can trust it to be real?
If he's not joking, of course. I mean, but in that case, hold on. But no, you're asking. Hold on.
Start over again with joking.
Okay, no. But your point is, if he's, I mean, every time that he speaks authoritatively, he's speaking as president of the United States.
Well, but is he? Every time he speaks authoritatively, he speaks as president. I mean, he is president of the United States, but authoritatively. Richard in Nashville, Tennessee. Richard, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Real quick, I've been a lifelong Republican voter, but this election changed my mind. Not just this, but many things leading up. But this was the final blow that if they can support a man like Donald Trump, who, in my mind, is very unstable, the Republican Party has become unstable. And that's why I don't vote Republican anymore, one thing among many. But that's the main thing. This man disappears unstable, and I think the party is unstable because they support him so vehemently.
Richard, I wish you luck on your political path, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more from Medina, Ohio. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is Kathy, and I'm just wondering why, Sean Spicer isn't being held accountable during these press conferences. He can go ahead and say something like, oh, yeah, we've got it. There's a lot of evidence backing it up. But nobody follows up on that. What is the evidence? Nobody's actually, he's controlling these press conferences in a way that the real questions aren't getting out there.
Well, I mean, I take your point. The holding Sean Spicer is one thing. He wasn't elected, though. I mean, the president is the real accountable political figure here. Peter Nicholas, what about the House Intelligence Committee request by midnight last night that there be evidence in their hands? And it wasn't there. The Justice Department said, please give us more time. But
right.
Where does that stand? Is there any real move here to try and nail this down?
Well, I think there is. Yes, the intelligence committees have asked for any sort of FISA court authorization or court order or any documentation that would back up substantially what the president said. Justice Department has asked for more time. We don't know what the deadline is. To some degree, the intelligence committees are depending on the good faith cooperation of the Justice Department. If Justice Department resists, there's a possibility of a subpoena. But I think one date we should consider, Tom, is March 20th, and that's when FBI Director James Comey will appear on the Hill for a hearing. He's going to be asked pointedly by the Intelligence Committee whether there is any evidence to back up the president's claim that Obama wiretapped Trump Tower during the campaign. And Comey, my guess, is going to answer that directly. Our reporting shows that Comey has asked the Justice Department to rebut this claim, so we believe his answer is going to be no, and that may settle the matter because I think having that kind of on-the-record, decisive, clear statement from the FBI director
no evidence.
May be all we need to know.
Well, we'll see. We're looking at Donald Trump, President Trump's claim that he was wiretapped by Barack Obama, President Barack Obama. Now, Peter, what you raised there, though, I mean, that hearing is about whether the Trump campaign was working with Russia to win the election, I guess, broadly speaking. I mean, and that leaves me with this question. Isn't it true that the Obama administration was looking into that question? It came up. It was a target of interest before the election, was it not?
Yes, it was. So this could backfire in a sense.
What do you mean?
Well, it could backfire because it's possible there was some kind of there was an investigation going on. There was some sort of surveillance going on, perhaps not in the way Trump described it, where Obama is illegally ordering a wiretap of Trump's phones at Trump Tower. But possibly there was some surveillance as U.S. investigators looked into the question of Russian interference in the election. And that
would that be inappropriate or appropriate?
No. Well, that would be if they got proper court orders and legal authorization. That is an appropriate way to investigate such a matter. But that could raise questions about the actions of people close to Trump or Trump surrogates during the campaign. And that's not necessarily where Donald Trump wants the focus to be right now.
I guess not. Adil in New Orleans, Louisiana. Adil, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
It was a question and not a question. Actually, what we see in the pattern of Trump that he's doing, it's always about the Nixon things that that mixed Nixon out. It was the tap and the wiretap and the major of it. And then he would make actually this pattern of outrage certain things that it doesn't going to bite him back. And he does those, you know, like he started with the media, that's because he wanted actually to push the media out. He you know, single a lot of, you know, major people that they can actually just coming back to him.
Adil, I think we got it. I mean, you're raising the Nixon years as a reference point here, and that's interesting. And I want to put it to Thomas Mann, if I may. Adil, thanks for your call. Tom Mann, what about the Nixon example? Things got awfully fraught there under Watergate. Was he coming out? We didn't have Twitter then, but was he, you know, writing, saying in the night, XYZ, publicly, false claims or unsubstantiated?
Well, in a sense, but he was more careful in his public statements than those recorded on tape in his private room. He was obviously misusing authorities of his government and the administration and ultimately lying about it. That was serious enough to lead to a bipartisan investigation of the matter and ultimately his resignation and in the face of impeachment. What's going on now, I suppose, if Trump is actually implicated in the Russian involvement in our election, and and he's worried about the upcoming investigations, and he's trying to distract attention, there could be a similarity. The one thing that really worries me is the delay on the part of the Justice Department. I hope it's the search for documents, but Comey was prepared to say there's nothing there weeks ago, and yet the Justice Department needs a little more time. My guess is, if anything, there's constant surveillance by the intelligence community of the Russian government, and it's quite possible they picked up a call with someone out of Trump Tower. It could have been Roger Stone or Peter Manafort, or it could have been a member of the Trump family. Who knows? But that's not the president wiretapping or even surveilling. That is simply the routine efforts of the intelligence department to monitor the Russian government.
Peter Nicholas, after a very hot charge like this, it seems to me the American people deserve to know the truth. Are we going to?
I think the best we're probably going to get from this is what James Comey's testimony on March 20th before the House Intelligence Committees. I would look for some clarity at that moment.
Doesn't the president have some responsibility himself to, if he wants to maintain his authority and credibility here?
He does, but you pointed to this earlier. He does not like to apologize. He doesn't like to retreat and give ground, and I wouldn't expect him to do it.
Well, and here we are. Peter Nicholas is White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Peter, thank you very much for spending a little time with us today.
Good to be with you.
And Thomas Mann is with us from Berkeley, California, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, co-author of It's Even Worse Than It Looks and The Broken Branch. Thomas Mann, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. Enjoyed it.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.